Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and my guests today are Rowan Miller and Diego Vega of the Entity Framework team. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
This is part two of our two-part review of the Entity Framework. In part one, which was going to be 30 minutes long, we were going to split sort of an hour and a half. We were going to do 30 minutes. It wound up being closer to 50 because the demos were so cool,
yep.
And I didn't feel like cutting you off at the 30-minute mark. Plus, I wasn't even looking at a clock, so the time just flew. But we reviewed features of Entity Framework 4.2, and we looked at the different workflows. Database first. We started with code first, then database first, then model first, I believe.
That's correct.
Where the order we did the three things in. And that kind of brought us up to speed with the current version of Entity Framework, which is 4.2. And you showed how to get 4.2 from NuGet. And that's where we left off.
That's
and
correct.
So what we're going to do today is talk about some features in Entity Framework 4.3, which is the next version.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to look at code-first migrations.
That's correct.
And then we're going to talk a little bit about what's coming even in the future.
Absolutely.
Okay. So then I guess the question that I want to start with is, how do I know what the latest version is? And if I'm in NuGet and I type install package entity framework, how do I know what version am I getting and how do I know which ones are out there?
Okay, so if you install with NuGet, you're going to get the latest fully supported version. And at the moment, that's 4.2.
Okay.
They've also added a new feature recently to install pre-release versions. So in NuGet, you can tell it to not only search fully supported versions, but also include new release versions, which at the moment, 4.2 is the latest version. We don't have any pre-release ones after that. Shortly, we'll be releasing a beta of 4.3. And so when you specify to include pre-release versions, it will include that beta and give it to you.
Okay. All right.
The other way to tell, if you just go to NuGet.org mm-hmm. and look under Packages, and Entity Framework happens to be on the top of the list, if you scroll down, it will give you the version history here.
Oh, I see.
So you'll be able to see. And the beta ones and pre-release will be really obvious. So 4.3 will be 4.3.0-beta1
mm-hmm.
will be its version number.
And so I could install one of the previous versions?
Yeah, so also when you're installing via NuGet with the Package Manager console, you can use the dash version switch, which will allow you to specify any of these versions and install.
Right, because if we, you know, if we're building an application, right, and we are, you know, in the late stages of the application, mm-hmm. we're using 4.1.0311.
You can see why we swapped to semantic versioning, right?
Yeah, and I want you to test that,
mm-hmm.
or add some functionality to it. If you just go into NuGet and type install package entity framework, you're going to get 4.2.
That's correct.
Which is not exactly the same version. And then when you send it back to me, there's going to be a mismatch.
That's
right.
Correct.
So you can specify which version to use. Can you do you can do that in the Package Manager console. Can you also do that in the UI?
Through the UI, I think you can only get the latest. You need to use Package Manager console to specify the version.
Right. Okay. Cool.
All right, so I thought we'd start off in Visual Studio. We're going to be showing migration, so we saw code first last time. So I'm going to start with a very similar application. So we're going to go ahead and use some code snippets. In fact, it's the same snippets we used last time. So we're at our blog class. Now it comes time to install Entity Framework. Now remember, we're going to use 4.3, which is not public yet. So you'll notice I'm using a local NuGet feed here that I've set up on my computer. By the time this video goes out, 4.3 beta may well be up on NuGet.
Okay.
So we're going to use install package and Entity Framework. Now this is where I specify the extra flag, which is include pre-release.
Okay.
So I'll go ahead and do that.
And it's got 4.3.0-beta1.
Yep.
That's a very understandable name.
It's a lot better than the seven-character long ones we had before, right? So. All right, so with that done, we can go ahead and define a context.
And everything that we showed in the first episode completely is the same,
yep.
right?
So we haven't made any changes so far. And in fact, we're going to do the same thing again, which is we're going to put in some code that actually uses our context. So don't worry too much about what this is doing. It's going to, every time we run the app, it's going to add a new blog to the database and then print out a list of all the blogs in the database.
Okay.
So as we run the app each time, we'll get more and more blogs in our database. Okay, so we saw last time I could press F5 and CodeFirst will create the database for me. Mm-hmm. We saw the problem with that is then if I change the model, CodeFirst doesn't know how to change the database. It only knows how to drop and recreate. So in 4.3, we get a new command in the package manager console, which is enable migrations. I'm going to go and run that command.
And that's in the package manager console. So that is going to download additional packages or turn on features?
It's actually just going to turn on some features for you. So the features are actually all in the assembly. You just need to add some extra code to your project to make migrations work. Okay. And so running this command, we'll see in a second, is going to actually add that code to our project.
So typically to make settings, you either set properties or maybe go into a config file or you go to tools options. Is this kind of a newer, cleaner way of doing that?
It's a more simple and more obvious way of doing it. So we were kind of experimenting. We weren't sure whether people would want a UI in Visual Studio or whether they'd be happy with a command line experience. We've got really good feedback on just doing it here.
Okay.
Some other things that kind of paved the way for doing this, MVC scaffolding actually uses the same approach. So you run your commands from package manager console.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is actually very cool because it's a PowerShell thing, right? I mean, on the package manager console.
Yeah. Right. So all we've done is have some PowerShell commands. We also have a standalone command line. So the commands we're going to run from here, you can also run from any normal command line as well.
Okay.
So let's enable migrations. Now, the cool thing about being in PowerShell, or in particular Package Manager console, is it actually knows quite a bit about your project. So it's filled in some stuff for us. Let's look at what it's done to the solution first. So it's gone ahead and added in a migrations folder. Mm-hmm. And this is where our code-based migrations are going to sit. And we'll see that in action in a little bit. The other thing it's done is add this configuration class. The configuration class basically tells migrations how I want it to migrate the database. So let's go and look at that class. Just get us a bit more real estate on the screen here. Okay. So we can see here we have a class from called configuration that derives from a DB migrations configuration, and it's for our context. Mm-hmm. So this lets migrations know that we've switched migrations on for the blog context, and here are the settings I want to run with. There's a lot of things we can set in here. One of them is whether automatic migrations is on or off. And I'll actually demo that feature a little bit later on. When I demo it, you'll see why we left it off by default, but you can opt into it and use it. The other thing we've got in here is a seed method, which allows you to have some seed data that should be put in the database after you upgrade to the latest version of your model.
Okay.
Some of the other things you can do in this class, you can change the code generator. So if you don't like the way that we generate code, you can plug in your own here. You can also plug in database providers. So we ship a SQL Server and a SQL Compact provider by default, but you can register additional ones in this class as well. All right, so it's time to add our first migration. So I'm going to call the add migration command, and we get to give our migrations a name. So I'm going to call this my first migration. And what this is going to do, migrations is going to look at my current model, which is a simple model with one class in it. Right. It's going to look at what's in the database. We don't have a database yet, so we haven't pushed anything there. And it's going to scaffold a code-based migration to take us from the current version, which is non-existent, up to what the model currently looks like. So if I run this, we'll see that it's gone and added this My First Migration class to our project. And if I go to a Solution Explorer, we'll see that it's added it inside the Migrations folder here.
Okay.
And the code in this looks fairly similar to most of the other migration products out there on the market, right? This is some kind of code that tells migrations what it needs to do to the database to apply this migration. So if I'm going up, which means going from non-existent to the first version of my model, I need to create a new table. The name of that table is blogs. It has a blog ID, a name, and a URL column. Name and URL are strings. Blog ID is an integer. And in this case, identity is switched on, meaning the database is going to generate values.
Okay. So if you had just pressed F5, the database would have been created.
Mm-hmm.
But this is basically putting into code what the runtime is going to do anyway. And this gives you your starting point for future migrations.
Absolutely.
So if you're never literally going to migrate anywhere, if this is you just create your model and go, this is kind of redundant, unless you just want to see what the code looks like.
Absolutely, and we'll see in a second how these migrations build up over time. So you have a very well-defined process for how do I get my application from empty to the current version. This becomes more important too when you have released version 1 and then you need to release version 2 in the future. Mm-hmm. So at that point we need to have a well-defined process for how does my schema go from version 1 to version 2.
Right. It also would give you the ability to go backwards in time.
Absolutely.
Without losing data.
So we'll see here the down method tells it to drop the table blocks.
Okay,
so we know how to go up and down through this migration.
Right.
So once we have migrations, we use the update database command to push those migrations to the database. So I'm going to run that. And we can see here that it's applied one migration, which is my first migration.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go to our database now, and I'm just going to refresh.
There it is.
As expected, we've got the single blogs table in our database. Mm-hmm. You'll also notice we no longer have the EDM metadata table. Because we're using migrations, migrations knows what changes are pending with the database. So it no longer needs to have that table to tell it whether the database matches the model.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so let's run our app. And as expected, it inserts a new blog and then prints that out to the console.
Right.
All right, now let's make a change to our model. And this is where we kind of hit the pitfall of the previous version. So I'm going to go ahead and add, say, a rating property to the blog.
And now if you run this...
If we run this, we will actually get an exception because...
Blows up, right?
Yeah, because the model doesn't match the database.
Let's see that.
Okay. It's actually going to be a different exception this time. And what it's going to do is tell you, instead of using database initializers, to consider using migrations.
Okay, that's cool. So it's a version-dependent message.
Yep.
I like that.
Yep. All right, cool.
Because just in 4.2, it's quite a bit longer.
It's quite long because the solution to the problem is quite long and complicated.
It's probably the longest exception message we ever produced.
I think so. Yep.
All right. Try to edit it and make it smaller.
So then we're going to use the add migration command again. Remember, this is going to look at my model and what's already been pushed to the database and work out what the changes are. So we'll call this my second migration. And again, we'll see over here in the solution that we've now got two migrations. And we can start to see these things have a prefix with a timestamp, so we have like an ordered set of steps to go through to bring the database between any two versions. This is pretty similar. We're adding a single column called ratings. Now we're actually adding a column that's not nullable to the database. Right. By default, it's going to put the CLR default value in any existing data, which would be 0. But we might want things to have a default rating of 3. So this is where I can start to add some very much database-specific code to this file. So I could say the default value for this is actually 3. And while we're here, let's go ahead and create an index on that column as well. You can see these are things that aren't really expressed in the code-first model, but they are very relevant to the database, so we can add them in here. So with those changes made, let's go ahead and use update database again. This time I'm going to specify the dash verbose flag. This is going to give me some extra logging so I can see what migrations is doing. So I'll let it run. And then we can actually see the SQL that migrations is running on the database. So we can see that it's creating the rating column with a default value of 3. And we can see that it's creating the index we specified as well. And of course, I can make it a unique index if I wanted to. There's some additional parameters I can specify.
So this it's not backing up the data. It's not doing anything that you couldn't do yourself in SQL Management Studio or through T-SQL.
Yep.
Obviously, as we see here, it's sending T-SQL. It's just doing it all for you. That's so cool.
And like I said, so there's obviously a translation process that goes on here because the code that I had is not database specific. It's just C-sharp,
right?
There was no mention of varchar max or anything like that. We have a translation process that takes that object model and translates it to database-specific SQL.
Mm-hmm.
We include the translators for SQL Server and CE, but of course any third party can just implement the interfaces.
Right.
And they're pretty simple.
It would also support SQL Azure at this point?
Yes, this works with Azure as well.
Yep.
Yep. I think it's important to mention that some people may not like the fact that we are just touching the database and sending commands to modify the structure of the database. There is a way to get the script with all the changes.
Yeah,
so update database dash script will give you a SQL script that you can apply yourself, or perhaps you want to get a script that goes between two versions.
So yeah, you don't necessarily have the ability to alter table, right? Not every developer is given the right to go muck with the schema.
Yeah, so you probably have it on your local development machine while you're working. When it comes time to deploy, you might work in an organization that has a DBA that says, I want a SQL script.
Right.
At that point, you can use the update database command. You can specify a source and target migration. So you might know that the production database is at version 2.5 and you want to upgrade to version 3.0.
Yep.
You may choose to call your migrations 2.5 and 3.0, or you might know you want to go from my second migration to my 21st migration.
Right.
At that point, you can use the update database command, specify those two migrations, use a dash script, and you have a script to pass to your
DBA. My computer clearly loves what you're showing.
Yeah, first applause, yep. All right, so there may come a point in time where you're kind of happy that migrations is working out this really easy stuff for you. So if I add a column, do I really want another class in my project, or am I happy for migrations just to apply that?
Okay.
This is where automatic migrations comes in. So let's go ahead and switch it on.
Right, so actually, so the blog class, go back to where the blog class is defined.
Okay, so blog is right here.
Okay. So you added rating there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so...
So the process it goes through, migrations will look at your current model, which has a blog class with rating in it.
Right.
It will look at what the model looked like last time it generated a migration, which was basically the same model, just without the ratings property.
Right.
It will compare the two, and then it scaffolds its best guess at what it thinks you want to do in the database, which in this case was pretty obvious. We want to add an integer column called rating.
Right.
It then generates the code for you, and you can edit that code if you want to. Or you can just look at it and decide it's right.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you then use update database to push those changes. Now, of course, we may not want to do that, so let's add another one. Let's add a string property called info. So we could use add migration. We'd see that it's going to say add column info. We could then run it and push it to the database.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably a little bit cumbersome. So we can switch on automatic migrations. And then without doing add migration, I can just do update database. Again, I'm going to specify the verbose flag so we can see what's happening. And if I zoom in, you can see it's actually applied an automatic migration, and it's altering the table. So it's working out the changes and then pushing them into the database for me.
Okay.
Now you can actually interleave these kind of code-based migrations and automatic ones. You might notice here the migration files that we have actually have a separate code behind file here. And this code behind file stores some information about the model before and after this migration was run. That model information can then be used to kind of replicate any automatic migrations you do in between code-based migrations.
Okay.
So again, in the future, if I made a more complicated change and wanted to use a code-based migration, I can go through that process.
So that would be how you would be able to start from the original model and then replicate each step?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay, so let's blow away our database now. Let's go ahead and get rid of this database. Okay, so I could be a developer. Someone else has checked in these changes. I've just pulled down our code base from source control, but I don't have a database yet.
Right.
If I now go to Visual Studio and do update database, it's actually going to go through the process of applying all of those migrations.
Right.
So we can see here that it's gone through applying my first migration, which was our code base one, created the blogs table. It's gone through applying my second migration. That was also a code-based one. It added the ratings column.
Yep.
Then it's going to run that automatic migration we did,
right,
which went ahead and applied the info table.
So show me the code for the automatic migration.
There actually isn't any.
Oh, there isn't
any. Which
is
a great thing.
Yeah.
Yep. It's actually doing the same calculation every time.
Ah.
So what it's doing is looking at the model at the end of this migration.
Okay.
Then looking at the current model and working out what needs to be done.
Okay, so if you do the automatic migrations, you lose the code-based trail of how you got there, which you may or may not care. I mean, the database is the database, right?
Yeah.
Because at this point, you could press F5, and the database will be created based on your model.
Yeah.
So do you need the code for the intermediate steps?
Yeah, so this gets much more important if you're a developer and you have, like, V1 of the database on your machine. Then you pull down some of these changes. you probably don't want to blow away that database and lose all the data. You want to incrementally apply their changes to your existing database.
Right.
Yeah. Or if you are working in a team and there are like several developers with slightly different versions of the schema and they are updating it.
You can imagine, too, deploying to a customer's site. So you might have some customers on 2.1, some customers on 2.1.2, some on 2.2, and all three of those customers want to upgrade to 3.
Right.
That's three different scripts. Well, migrations will actually work that out for you because it knows the steps to get from each of those versions up to the current version.
So you can do that at runtime? Because it's all done through a...
It's all done through an API. So we could. I'll just write the code for you here. We have this class called a dbmigrator, which I misspelled. And the DB migrator just takes our configuration, which was our configuration class, which is defined in the migrations namespace. So that's the class we have in our project.
Mm-hmm.
And then from here, I can just call update, which will update my database to the latest version. Or you'll notice in here there's also an overload that tells you, tells migrations which version to upgrade to.
Okay.
We actually went a little bit further.
So as long as you include that migrations folder, right? Mm-hmm.
So the code's actually compiled into your application. So it actually doesn't need the folder on disk. It'll pull the code out of your application.
I got it. So you'd send a new version of the application, and in that you'd call the migrator.
Mm-hmm.
You could also potentially send the migrator as a standalone exe.
Absolutely,
sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this doesn't have to be in the same project as all your other code. Right. This can be in a separate project.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, last time we looked at database initializers, and we saw by default there's one that creates a database. You can swap it to one that drops and recreates the database if the model changes. We're actually in 4.3 adding a new one, which is we can set the initializer to migrate database to latest version.
Ah, okay.
So I can set an initializer to save myself writing those two lines of code.
Right.
So the one other thing I wanted to show was just that target version thing. So I can say update database. Target migration equals, let's go back down to the state at the end of my first migration. Okay, so what it's telling us here.
I was just about to ask you what happens to the data.
Okay, yeah.
Because we already said we're not backing it up.
Yep, so if you go down through migrations and you're dropping columns, then the data's gone.
Right.
You can, of course, if you want to,
override
edit the down script. So we saw in our migrations, we have the ability to control what happens in the down process.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not okay with losing data, that's fine. Just get rid of this code and the data will stay there. To say that we're okay with data loss, we're going to use the dash force flag, which says I'm okay with data loss. This time I do it. And I actually made a boo-boo here. And this is fairly easy to debug. If we go into the second migration one, it's trying to roll this back. In here, we created an index. In the down method, we're actually not dropping that index.
Ah.
So dropping this column fails. So we'd want to go ahead and in here, add a drop index.
Do you have to do it first?
We do, yes. And this is the great thing about the migrations process being transactional, is I can just iterate on these things and fix them. Okay. We might have a bug in there. Did I mention we haven't released this yet?
But you could also write code in there to back up that data or something,
Yeah, you could.
Right?
So maybe you want to create a backup table, and you want to take the data out and copy it in, and then drop the existing table.
Yeah. Right.
You can also execute like raw SQL statements, right?
So you can write any arbitrary SQL you want.
So your up and down could manage these sort of interim or history tables, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to drop the data, we're going to get rid of a column, but we're going to make a copy of that table or make a separate table that just has that data.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we go up, we're going to add, but we're going to grab the columns. You could write whatever you wanted to manage the data.
Absolutely.
That's cool.
There's two ways to do that. One, you can write raw SQL. If you have things that you find you're doing over and over again, but we haven't added to the product yet, then we've actually made the model very extensible. So it's quite easy for you to define your own kind of builder methods in here that allow you to kind of add your own commands. You can then wrap our provider and tell the provider how to generate the SQL for those particular commands. Mm-hmm. So you might have a move command that you decide has this pattern for generating SQL. You add some extra information here, and then you kind of wrap our provider and tell the provider how to process that move command.
Cool.
Then you hopefully email us and tell us to put it in the product if it's good. So.
Excellent.
I think that's all we've got on migrations, unless there's awesome. Anything else you want to see.
No, that's cool. That's
all right, really cool. So look for that coming out soon on NuGet. Hopefully it will be out by the time this video goes up. If not, it's only a matter of weeks away.
Excellent.
So I think now we wanted to talk about what's coming up in the future. Sound good? So in the last segment, we went through this slide, which talked about all the versions that we've currently shipped.
Right.
What folks probably want to see is what's coming next. So let's talk about what's 4.2 onwards. So the upcoming versions we have, I think I'll probably cover 4.3, and then do you want to do 5?
Yeah, sure.
Cool. All right, so the next release that's coming out is EF4.3. This is the next logical step to EF4.2. Mm-hmm. It's going to be on NuGet only, the same as 4.2 was, and continues to build on .NET 4.0, and it has some extra features for Code First and the DB Context API.
Okay.
So just running down the list here, the biggest reason we're doing 4.3 is to get migrations in people's hands. Right. So this will be the first go-live release of migrations. We have some improved database generation, and this goes hand-in-hand with migration. So we had a DDL provider that we were using in the first version that we shipped of Code First. It was actually in 4.0 that sort of said, given this model, how do I create the database? Mm-hmm. When it's available for providers that have migrations providers, they're a little bit smarter, and so we're actually swapping to use that when it's supported and then falling back to the existing DDL provider if it's there. This has some bonuses. For one, like we generate indexes on foreign key properties, mm-hmm. which is something people have been asking for. Because our DDL provider is in the .NET framework, we couldn't update that yet. So we've gone ahead, and when you use the migrations provider, you'll get indexes on your foreign key constraints.
Okay.
Some other things, we have a predictable algorithm for primary key constraint names. One of the complaints we heard from people is our primary key names are generated by SQL Server, which means they're not predictable. They're kind of based on the point in time that you create them. So now you'll get well-known names. On top of that, we've got a bunch of bug fixes going in. Mm-hmm. These are bugs that customers have told us about that are blocking people from writing applications. So we took the opportunity to take those bug fixes, roll them in, ship it as EF 4.3.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Cool.
Cool.
So before we get on to 5, go back for a second. So I love the idea that there are these easy-to-get interim releases, right? In the old days, you were constrained to the box, mm-hmm. right? So between 3, 5, and 4, you did a bunch of work, and then you had to wait for 4 to ship Visual Studio 2010,
correct.
And then you dumped a whole bunch of stuff, and then you immediately went on to preparing the next version, and there would be these potentially long gaps.
Yep.
You could do things in a service pack. Service packs, you know, they're not supposed to have new features, but sometimes they do. Mm-hmm. But this way, you have the flexibility. If a feature takes 6 weeks to do, mm-hmm. That's probably a little optimistic. If a feature takes 3 months
yep.
to get ready, then 3 months later you can release the next version.
Absolutely.
Right? So that's awesome. So a couple questions around that. Have you given thought to, when I fire up Visual Studio, letting me know, sort of like, you know, Windows Update. Windows will often, and quite often, tell me that there are new updates, mm-hmm. you need to install them, or would you like to install them? So would Visual Studio have a service that knows what I have and is then telling me there's a new version of Entity Framework?
That's actually feasible inside NuGet itself. So because we're just releasing as a NuGet package, NuGet knows what current version you have installed. It also knows what versions are available on the web.
Right.
So we could. I don't think they've implemented it yet, although I might be wrong because they've just released NuGet 1.6. You could easily have a feature that says, hey, there's a new version of this NuGet package. Do you want to pull it down?
And that would be proactive, so I'd open the project and visual, and I would then be told, hey, we see you're using 4.2, mm-hmm. 4.3's out, would you like to use it?
Yeah.
So yes, no, learn more.
Yeah, we could absolutely do that. Okay. They may have put it in 1.6, I don't think it's there. They're certainly easy to update, so you go into either the UI or Package Manager console and you can mm-hmm. easily pull down updates. Mm-hmm. For your NuGet packages.
We ship other bits as V6 installers, like mm-hmm. extensions for
right.
Visual Studio.
Yep.
Like we have a code generation template that we ship in that way.
Yep.
And for that, you get also a notification in Visual Studio telling you there is a new version.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Excellent.
Yep.
Cool.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about what comes after EF 4.3.
It's 4.5, right? To match the .NET framework version.
Not exactly. So when we decided to adopt semantic versioning, we knew that when we need to make breaking changes in a version, we need to update the major component of the version.
Right.
And that's the main reason we are talking about EF5. EF5 is going to be the next version of EF, the next major version that is going to be a combination of a NuGet package, like the same way we have been updating lately, but also with updates that we are incorporating in the EF core libraries that are part of .NET, and also in combination with updates to Visual Studio. So the entity designer that is part of Visual Studio is also going to be updated to support new features.
So that it's kind of a double-edged sword. In the past, what framework teams have basically done is stuck with the version of the framework, right? Mm-hmm. So there was Workflow 4 and Entity Framework 4, and then you kind of always knew what version were using. Now you're going to semantic versioning, which completely makes sense. This is a major version. Why wouldn't you change the 4 to a 5? And whether the framework does or doesn't is one thing, but are the other framework teams doing this? Is Workflow doing this? Is WCF doing this?
There's a relatively easy way to understand this. Is we entity framework now, what we call entity framework is not part of .NET. It's actually the NuGet package or the bits that we release in the NuGet package. So it's more like MVC.
Okay, right.
If you look at the versioning that MVC uses, they are in version 3, the next version is going to be version 4 and everything, and it's not really tied to the version of the .NET framework. EF is becoming more like that.
So will EF5 work in Visual Studio 2010?
It actually won't. So EF5 will have a dependency on some changes made in 4.5. Okay. So to use EF5, you would need an upgraded version of
Visual Studio. Okay, so it's more like Silverlight 3.4.5, MVC 3.4, the next version might be 5, okay.
So in the same way that MVC 3 requires .NET 4.0, well, EF5 is going to require .NET 4.5.
Right, okay.
And in future releases, we're going to try and minimize that so we can keep the lowest common denominator possible.
Well, it's better this way because I know that first of all, MVC 3 and 4 work both in 2010 and 11.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not necessarily tied to version of the framework.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it be called 4.5, MVC 4.5, if I can use from 2008 running on .NET Framework 3.5? So that makes no sense. So calling it 3 and 4 and 5, just like Silverlight did, tells me there's a new version out. Yeah. Oh, Entity Framework 5, there's a new version. Now there's going to be requirements, right? Mm-hmm. Tooling's only available in 11, requires a particular version of the framework. It makes way more sense once you break the...
In fact, if you're actually in Visual Studio 2010 and you type install package entity framework, it's going to automatically work out that, or actually even if you're in Visual Studio 11 and you're targeting .NET 4, it's actually going to install version 4.0 of entity framework for you. You don't need to be aware of that. It's going to install the latest version that's supported on the target framework.
Yeah, this is way better.
Yeah. Okay.
Speaking, as a customer, putting on my customer hat.
I'm happy to hear that you like it.
I do.
We are a little concerned about the possible confusion, but...
Anytime you change naming, there will be some confusion, but eventually, and fairly quickly, people will figure it out. I mean, they're already used to it with the MVC, with the Silverlight, so you're just following that trend.
Yeah.
It's way cleaner.
Yeah, we believe that we can explain this, and we couldn't explain if we didn't do this. So
yeah.
Okay, so what is in EF5? So there are a bunch of features that are going to be usable independently of which workflow you are using and independently of which API you are using, like support for enums and special types like geography and geometry types. You can now do queries for proximity or things like that. There are performance improvements that we made, and we're going to explain a little bit more about that.
Okay.
And there are a bunch of bug fixes, of course. There are also improvements that are specific. If you have like table valued functions in your database, you can now access those. You can map those to a model in Entity Framework.
Cool.
And if you have stored procedures that return multiple results. If you have like multiple select statements inside your stored procedure, you can now...
I bet that was a much requested feature, eh?
Yeah, yes. Close behind enums.
Yes, and also there are improvements in the designer. So the entity designer that is part of Visual Studio is, of course, incorporating support for enum special types and all the new features that require changes in the model, and also has some features of its own, like the ability to have multiple diagrams in the same model, the ability to colorize the shapes in the model. Like you can have all your entities that are related to customer in red, for instance, if you want.
Cool. Okay.
And also, well, it has some usability improvements like support for importing several store procedures in one step. And also, when you select a navigation property or when you select an association, now you are going to see highlighting in several places. It's much nicer.
Can you import stored procedures related to an entity as a batch, or is it all or nothing?
No, really, you need
to... Don't you love somebody who hears a feature for the first time and they immediately think up new things?
It's like, yeah, we're pretty used to that.
Whether a stored procedure is associated with an entity or not is kind of opaque at design time, so you need to actually tell us this stored procedure is for this entity.
Okay.
So it's hard
cool,
to guess.
That's cool, because the steps for importing a stored procedure, it's a lot of clicking. It's very... Right, you got to do it over and over again, so the ability to do it batch is cool. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so just a note on this. We talked last time about the fact that sometimes when we want to add a new feature, we need to make changes in the libraries that we have that are part of the framework, and that's harder, and we cannot do it as often. So we are working, as Rowan said, like to get away of that situation and be able to do like deeper features more often.
Right.
But for .NET 4.5, and EF5, this is still the situation. It's like we can only, for instance, implement enum if we update.
Well, that's to be expected, right? I mean, you have the opportunity every now and again to update the base framework. You're not going to do that on an interim basis, presumably. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we want that necessarily, changing the core framework. Any team can change the core framework whenever they want between major releases. We probably don't want that, but you know, 4.5 build off that, and then 5.5.5.6, however far you get, will all be based on 4.5.
Yeah, it's interesting because like the features that we implemented in EF5 are, most of them are like at the top of the list of the feedback that we get. We have a site, I don't know if you can open it, the EFMSwitch.net. Is a URL that points you to a user voice site in which we get feedback about the most requested features.
And so you've been making good use of the user voice?
Yes, cool. It's excellent. And we get a lot of feedback here, and the voting system is very good.
Excellent.
One of the interesting things is that one of the requests that we had close to the top is it's too much to wait for the next version of Visual Studio. So we are trying to address that.
Yeah, okay.
So I would like to invite people to, and encourage people to actually go use this and give us more feedback.
Yeah, just to reiterate the URL, you don't need to remember that big thing on the screen. It's ef.mswish.net.
Okay. Cool.
Okay.
Excellent.
So let's go to the next slide then. Oh no, let's type a little bit of code. So one of the things I wanted to explain a little bit more is the kind of performance that you can expect from EF5. So I would like to like help people like create a mental model of what's happening when they execute a query using EF. Mm-hmm. So let's do something like create a small query here from DB. Sorry. Let's start with this. So we have blocks. Let's say that we have a query that is something like b.blogid equals some ID. Let's say I will create a separate variable for that. Okay, so when I create a query like this, usually nothing really happens. It's the query is created as a data structure that represents a query that needs to be translated in order for it to do any work. When you do when you execute something like the first operator on link, this one is actually going to force the execution of the query.
Right.
So let's use B1 here. Anyway, so the thing is that only when I execute this first operator, this query that I wrote before is going to get translated into, in this case, Transact SQL, because I'm using a SQL Server backend. But before that happens, a lot of things need to happen. If this is the first query that my application is executing, actually, Entity Framework is going to do a lot of work to figure out the mapping and to load all the metadata that it has about the database, about the objects, and how things need to map in order to be able to translate the first query. So we have made a few changes there so that more of that information is loaded faster. So we fix actually a bunch of bugs. It's that you can expect that process is going to be twice as fast in the next version of EF5. Then after that, when the query, like when all the metadata is loaded and all the, like EF has figured out all the mapping and everything, there are a couple of things that need to happen. First, here I have a parameter. So in link, I need to actually be able to access the value of that parameter. And that's a process that in the previous version of EF, we used to be very expensive. So we made changes there to make it super cheap. Okay. So that is going to have an impact, especially if you have an application that executes many queries. Like, let's say you have an MVC application, you have like customers or clients that are hitting the server all the time and they are executing similar queries all the time. So loading the parameters and being able to figure out the values is going to be much faster. So that's going to have an impact. And also, another thing that we did is that when we find two queries that are similar, or even like the same query is executed twice in different requests in a web server, we now cache the translation of the query.
Okay.
Meaning that the second time you execute the same query, this is going to be much faster. It's like we don't need to do look at all the mapping and say, okay, the Transact SQL for this query is this. We just say, it's a cache lookup. We find it. We execute it immediately.
Ah, okay.
So just to give you an idea of what the impact, the real impact is, we have this slide in which we are showing some targeted benchmark results. So for just to measure like the overhead of executing that second query once we have figured out all the mapping and we are just measuring like the difference between 4.0 and 5.0 regarding like just loading the parameters and executing the corresponding Transact SQL query, you are going to see that link to entities, the green bar, in 5.0 is more than 5 times faster than the previous version. So that's just for link to entities. In Entity SQL, there are also improvements. And you'll see that although we haven't invested a lot on link to SQL lately, we are also improving the performance a little bit.
Do you have data for how many people using Entity SQL versus link to entities?
We believe that link to entities is much more popular.
Okay.
The reason most people use Entity SQL is because they want to get better performance. For instance, you have in 4.0, you had like the bar in for Entity SQL is much lower than link.
But it looks like in 5, a lot of that disappears.
Exactly.
Okay. Because obviously, link to entities, it's link, so it's way more familiar.
Yes, and it gives you all the nice experience of IntelliSense and the fact that it's statically typed. And also, here, the bars to explain what they mean, this is the overhead that we have over just executing hand-coded AD.NET code that would do the same thing. It's like you load a command, you execute it, you get the reader, and then you create an object manually, and you assign the values from the different columns to the properties of that object. That is like 100%, and this is what we have on the left, and this is like the performance of the other ways of doing it with Link.
Cool.
And just this is super targeted, so I wouldn't claim that these results are going to be what you are
going
to get.
Your mileage may vary, but this shows that obviously you've been working on it a lot, and there's extremely promising progress.
To show you something that maybe a little bit more representative of what you can get in your application, I'm not claiming again that this is exactly the kind of performance improvement that you are going to see. We internally use a version of PetShop, the classic performance benchmark, to measure our performance. And when we checked in those changes, we saw a spike of, like, the performance improved 67%.
Wow, cool.
And this is like more end-to-end, executing several different queries and exercising several paths.
Excellent. Cool. That's it. Faster is definitely better, so.
Okay.
That's great.
Especially when it comes to data access,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. Yep. Very, very cool. All right, so anything else you guys want to cover?
I think that's all we've got at the moment.
All right. So the Entity Framework 5 will appear in Visual Studio Beta, Visual Studio 11 Beta, which is fairly soon. And the developer preview had the 4.0 bits, right?
Yes,
that's correct, yeah.
To make it clear. Okay.
So 5.0 obviously is going to go out on NuGet. We'll actually publish the package as soon as the next preview of .NET 4.5 is available.
Okay. And so what we'll do once the beta's out, then you guys will come back and show us some demos with the new features, and then we'll have the trifecta, part one and part two of what you can do today, and then part three, what's coming up. And
sounds good.
Sounds great.
All right. Awesome.
Okay.
Cool.
So I hope you enjoyed this longer than we originally expected, but excellent look at the Entity Framework. And I think at this point, I think we're up to speed on what's been done since 4.0 shipped, and we've got good demos of what you can do today and a good sense of what's coming. So that's great. There are good walkthroughs that are on the Data Developer site. I know Julie Lerman has done some videos and some articles. They're very good. We are working on an Entity Framework hands-on lab that will wind up in the Visual Studio 2010 training kit. We initially wrote it for 11, but then it turns out it works just fine in 2010. So we'll do that. We'll have that training kit out in the Visual Studio 2010 training kit very soon, because it's pretty much done. And then I think we'll do a lab for 11, include that in the Visual Studio 11 training kit when we do the beta refresh for that. So go to the Data Developer Center on MSDN, look for that hands-on lab in a next release of the 2010 training kit. And if you haven't dived into the Entity Framework yet, now is the time. It's easier than ever to learn. Originally, you know, you had to go buy Julie's book, which is nice and big and thick, and it's obviously a great book. But now, before you do that, there's a lot of great materials to get you started. Then go buy her book and really learn
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Might put in a shameless plug, too. We're actually working on two small updates to that book. So me and Julie teamed up. We actually did a code-first book. It's not 900 pages. It's 150, so you can get through it pretty quickly.
Okay.
That goes through everything you can do with code-first. We're just wrapping up another book, which is introducing the DB Context API. So that applies to model, database, and code first, and everything you can do with those.
Okay.
Again, that's about 200 pages, so a much shorter overview of everything that's new in DB Context.
Excellent. All right. We'll see you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.